Chapter 7 Defeat and Dishonor. Anthony Gonzalez was worried about the traffic on the morning of January 6th. The Ohio Republican had grown accustomed to a commute from Northwest Washington during the pandemic. With relatively few cars on the road, it usually took him about 12 minutes to reach the Capitol. But Gonzalez had expected the city to be busier that day. After all, he had spent the night before arguing with his fellow Republicans and beseeching them not to do more than they already had to stoke the anger of the Trump supporters converging on Washington. Gonzalez left home before dawn to beat the crowds, and even at that early hour he was struck by the number of buses crawling around Washington. There were already packs of people moving around the city, some with banners and signs. "Wow," Gonzalez thought to himself, "if it's already like this and it's 5 in the morning, I can only imagine what it's going to be like at noon." As Gonzalez was starting his day, a number of his colleagues were only just falling asleep. They had stayed up late, riveted by the returns in Georgia, and eager to see whether Democrats would capture the Senate and take full control of government. Since the election, it had been the previous day, January 5th, the date of the Georgia runoff, that lawmakers, party strategists, and the incoming administration had been eyeing most anxiously. But the first months of the Biden administration and the fate of both political parties would be shaped even more drastically by the events of January 6th. More than a few lawmakers had premonitions of the violence that day. Young Democratic lawmakers like Abigail Spanberger and Andy Kim, whose national security training had triggered a sense of imminent danger, as well as long-serving committee chairs like Maxine Waters and Adam Smith, who had spent enough decades in Washington to recognize that the atmosphere in the Capitol was not just tense, but explosive. Jason Crow, the Colorado Democrat who'd sent his family home in advance of the vote out of concern for their safety, may not have awakened quite as early as Gonzalez, but in the members-only gym that morning, the former Army Ranger had barely worked up a sweat when he got into a heated exchange with a Republican friend who was equally committed to fitness, Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma, a former mixed martial arts fighter. "People are going to get hurt today," Crow told Mullen. "Mark my words." The sense of foreboding was pervasive. Anna Eshoo, a California Democrat and a close friend of Nancy Pelosi, rode to the Capitol and was surprised, looking at its east side, to see how few police officers were stationed there. Like other lawmakers, Eshoo had received an email 2 days earlier from the House Sergeant-at-Arms urging members to arrive early and to use the tunnels under the Capitol rather than walking outdoors. An aide in the car with Eshoo wondered if the police presence was light because the officers were changing shifts. "No, they're not changing shifts at 8:45 a.m, Eshoo remembers replying. Eshoo did not share her next thought aloud, but in her head, she was contemplating a more ominous image, the scene from The Godfather, in which Sonny Corleone, the crown prince of his father's mafia empire, drives up to a seemingly sleepy toll booth, only to find himself in a fatal machine gun ambush. "I had a bad feeling," Eshoo says. "I had a bad feeling about that day." There was not a universal mood of gloom. In some corners of the government, there was a sense of optimism that the Trump era and the post-election standoff instigated by the president would soon be over. The certification vote would be an unsightly chore, and then that would be the end. In Northwest Washington, Chris Liddell, the transition-focused Trump aide, woke up and told his wife how relieved he was that a resolution was at hand. To Liddell, January 6th represented the possibility of closure, the full and final end to navigating around the president's obstinacy and delusional thinking. After Congress certified the results, he thought, there would be a glide path to the inauguration. Also in a cheery mood that morning was the senior senator from West Virginia. Joe Manchin, the centrist Democrat, was abuzz with optimism about what that day might bring and about the role he was poised to play in the new Congress as one of 50 crucial votes in the new Senate majority. Manchin, 73, had an extra reason to be enthused. He was on his way to get vaccinated against the coronavirus before that day's session got underway. Beyond his shot in the arm, Manchin was excited because Washington could get on with the transition to the work of a Congress that was about as evenly divided as it had ever been. That, he believed, was an ideal atmosphere for the deal-making he relished. and that the incoming Biden administration seemed eager to support. "We got a chance to bring bipartisanship back to the country," Manchin crowed. To the optimists in the nation's capital, it seemed the peaceful transfer of power was at hand. President Trump had other plans. Only a few hours later, the defeated president mounted a stage on the Ellipse between the Mall and the White House. The smooth transition to a Biden administration was the farthest thing from Trump's mind. Even the advent of the first coronavirus vaccines, a lightning-fast achievement that his advisors were pleading with him to embrace as a high note for his exit, was irrelevant to the president. Having spent 2 months attacking the integrity of the election results, Trump was not about to stop now. "We will never give up. We will never concede," he told all those people who had poured off the buses, Gonzalez observed. "You don't concede when there's theft involved." Firing up the crowd with Trump were a few of his political footmen, including Mo Brooks, the Alabama congressman who told the crowd to start taking down names and kicking ass, and Rudy Giuliani, who called for trial by combat over the election results. Making the Trump family's message crystal clear, the president's eldest son, Don Jr., aired a video of himself backstage at the rally, praising the White House aide Mark Meadows as an actual fighter, one of the few, before spinning his camera around to face his girlfriend, Kimberly Guilfoyle. "Have the courage to do the right thing," she said. "Fight!" True to form, Trump reveled in the size of his crowd and demanded the news cameras capture how many of his supporters he had summoned to Washington on the day Congress was to certify his defeat. The president also wanted his devotees to know who was to blame for his defeat, criticizing GOP leaders in Congress who led you down the tubes, and repeatedly hectoring Mike Pence to use his ceremonial role in the Senate to overturn the election. Republican voters, Trump said, should take revenge in 2022 on those who did not join his crusade to overturn Biden's election. He singled out one in particular. "We got to get rid of the weak Congress people, the ones that aren't any good, the Liz Cheneys of the world," he said, feeding the crowd the name of a highly recognizable Republican dissenter sure to be at work that day in the building down the mall. In the halls of Congress, lawmakers were still going about the business of the day without interruption. But the law enforcement officials at Trump's rally recognized a security threat when they saw it. "POTUS is encouraging the protesters to march to Capitol grounds and continue protesting there," an officer wrote. The country was perched on the edge of a political trauma, an act of mob violence that would mark an end of innocence moment for American democracy. 2 decades earlier, the Capitol had been spared from attack by foreign terrorists on the worst day in the country's modern history, September 11, 2001. Now it was on the verge of being defiled by American citizens whipped into a frenzy by their president. In some respects, the story of January 6th is of a near miss with catastrophe. The riot at the Capitol was a national disgrace, but there was no massacre of lawmakers, no assassination of the vice president or the House Speaker, no revolt in the armed forces, and no attempt by President Trump, with rank-and-file lawmakers locked down in office buildings and congressional leaders sequestered on a military base, to seize and hold power by brute force. But as a raw political trauma, it exceeded any other event in the history of the modern Congress. To many Americans and admirers of America, the implications of the insurrection were devastating. The images of lawmakers crouching in hiding or running in fear, of smashed glass and ransacked offices, of the Confederate flag unfurled in the Capitol more than a century and a half after Appomattox, taken together, they evoked Lyndon Johnson's description of another act of homegrown violence as the foulest deed of our time. On January 6th, all the most malevolent currents of the 2020 election and much of the poison of Trump's 4-year term converged on a single place at a single time. The result was an inflection point in the history of the Congress, the two parties, the not-yet-born Biden administration, and the country. It was a moment that clarified the true scale of the threat Trump posed to the country and exposed the degree to which America's divisions had come to imperil a right of democracy long taken for granted, the peaceful transfer of power. the attack of January 6th would wound lawmakers and change their outlook on their colleagues, their own roles, and on Congress as an institution. For Democrats, it would imbue them, at least briefly, with a sense of solidarity and mission, a burning desire to wield their new power to maximum effect, and, for many of them, to deposit Trump's congressional allies on the ash heap of history. They could not, and would not, forget the right-wing lawmakers who had enabled the insurrection, whether they did so by parroting Trump's lies on television, joining him at the Ellipse, or voting later that day to block certification of the vote. Among Republicans, January 6th seemed at first to be equally clarifying. In the harrowing hours of the Capitol siege, people at the highest level of the party believed they would no longer have to defend, excuse, or dodge the actions of a man many of them saw as something between clownish and cancerous. Yet it would become apparent soon enough that the GOP was at the start of a longer process of internal reckoning, a "which side are you on" moment that would throw Republicans into turmoil for months, or perhaps years, to come. As Trump concluded his midday remarks on January 6th, some lawmakers watched them live while others learned about them from reporters. For Republicans who were already poised to certify Biden's victory, defying Trump, his political entourage, and his mob, the president's line-crossing rhetoric steeled their spines to finish the job. "Our allegiance and our oath is to the Constitution and laws of the United States. They're not to any one person," said John Cornyn, the Texas senator, as he made his way through the Capitol before the rioters arrived. Asked if it was time for the Republican Party to move beyond Trump, Cornyn was circumspect about his party's relationship with the president, exhorting a horde to violence. "This is the beginning of a long process of reevaluation and reassessment," he said. "I think that's going to take a while." He could not have known in that moment how right he was. When pro-Trump rioters breached the Capitol, most senators were in their seats in the Senate chamber. But because of social distancing measures put in place during the pandemic, the 435 members of the House were far more scattered. Some were in their offices, some on the floor of the chamber, and a small number were seated above the floor as spectators in the House gallery. A select group had applied specially for the privilege. Val Demings was among those in the last group. The former Orlando police chief and vice presidential hopeful was excited to witness democracy in action. She had only just been sworn in to her third term as a member of the House, and she was thrilled to be among the members seated in the House gallery as the proceedings got underway. Though she was aware of the crowd outside the Capitol, Demings was not one of the lawmakers who sensed incipient violence. After all, she reflected, there are usually protesters at the Capitol, though on most days they numbered in the single and double digits. The members beside Demings in the gallery made up a cross-section of the Democratic caucus, including Jason Crow, the Biden confidant Lisa Blunt Rochester, straight-talking Pennsylvania lawyer Susan Wild, the suburban centrists Josh Gottheimer and Lizzie Fletcher, Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Raul Ruiz, the chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. They were all watching intently as the Republican challenge to the election began, with Republican members of the House speaking in Trump's name to make wild claims of election fraud. It was as Paul Gosar, a far-right Arizonan, claimed without evidence that his state's mail-in ballots had been doctored, that Nancy Pelosi's security detail swiftly took her from the dais where she had been presiding. At first, Pelosi was unsure why she was being yanked from the chamber. Sometimes her aides ushered her out as a political choice, to avoid having the speaker on the floor as Republicans engaged in some political stunt or another. Pelosi's two deputies, Steny Hoyer and Jim Clyburn, quickly exited the chamber behind her, with Hoyer's security detail escorting him out. When Gosar complained that the House was out of order, it was clear something was seriously amiss, and a voice rang out from the gallery. "This is because of you," shouted Dean Phillips, a normally mild-mannered Minnesota Democrat. Jim McGovern, the Democratic chairman of the Rules Committee, replaced Pelosi on the dais, while some staffers on the floor urged security officials in the gallery to lock the doors. McGovern soon gaveled the House into a recess, bringing an abrupt end, at least for the moment, to the Republicans' oratorical attack on the election results. In the gallery, members had realized that something dangerous was afoot. Demings immediately thought of her law enforcement training. There's an outer perimeter, there's an inner perimeter, and sometimes bad people get past the outer perimeter, Demings says, thinking back on that moment. But they never get past the inner perimeter. What I knew then, she says, was that all hell had broken loose, and we were in trouble. Near Demings in the gallery was Lizzie Fletcher, a Texas Democrat elected in the 2018 anti-Trump backlash to represent a district once held by George Herbert Walker Bush. Fletcher had chosen to wear a pair of Cole Haan flats that day because she knew it would be a long one. There was no telling how long the Republicans could drag out their quixotic objections. What Fletcher had not planned on was being told to wear a gas mask. "We have tear gas in the rotunda," a Capitol Police officer yelled out, referring to the cavernous hall beneath the building's great dome. "Please be advised there are masks under your seats." On the floor, Ruben Gallego, the Marine veteran from Arizona, removed his suit jacket and mounted a table usually reserved for speech scripts. He began instructing his colleagues on how to put on the masks. Most of them had not even known the gear was stowed there. Rank-and-file lawmakers had never been taught how to use them. In the gallery, Crow used his own military training, coaching his colleagues on how to don their masks. Ruiz, a former emergency room physician, helped out too. Another Democrat in the gallery, Diana DeGette of Colorado, was worried that security officials were so focused on securing the House floor that they had forgotten the group in the mezzanine seats. "What about us?" she called down to the floor. A mood of panic was setting in. Blunt Rochester, the Delaware Democrat, shared DeGette's concern that the group there had been forgotten. When someone dropped their phone and it clattered down the steps, Blunt Rochester remembers someone telling her not to pick it up because it could be a bomb. Squeezed on her knees between the first row of balcony-style seats and the railing, Blunt Rochester recited a prayer. She noticed some of her colleagues on the phone to family members or aides, but her own view was that the moment required divine intervention. "I said, you call your aunt, you call your mom. I'm calling Jesus," she says, citing the gospel standard, "Jesus on the main line." "Father God, you have all the power," Blunt Rochester said in the gallery, asking the Almighty to protect all of our brothers and sisters in this Congress. Crow did call his wife. He told her that he and his colleagues might either have to make a stand in the House gallery or fight their way out, and that he loved her and their children. The young congressman scanned the vicinity for any sort of weapon he could use, but found only a ballpoint pen. He contemplated whether he might ask a Capitol Police officer to give him a sidearm and decided it would be an inappropriate request. On the phone, his wife, Desiree, reminded Crow he was a father with obligations to his family. "Don't be a hero," she said. The doors to the gallery were now sealed, and the members were inside. The lawmakers could hear yelling and a gunshot, the bullet that felled the insurrectionist Ashley Babbitt as she tried to break into the House. And then someone began jostling the gallery doors from the outside. For those trapped within, it was a moment of cold terror. "I thought, who's on the other side of the door?" Fletcher says. "It turned out to be Capitol Police, and they showed us the way out." As they were fleeing the chamber, Crow looked back to the nearly abandoned House floor, where the burly colleague he had argued with that morning, Mark Wayne Mullen, was only a handful of people left there. "Mark Wayne," Crow called down to him, "you have to leave too." Mullen was loath to retreat from the floor, but the Capitol Police could not reposition themselves as long as they had members to defend there. Crow's pleas connected with Mullen, and he agreed to leave. On the way to the elevators, the lawmakers from the gallery passed a scene that Fletcher would later describe as burned into her memory. Capitol Police officers with automatic weapons drawn and pointed down at a group of rioters spread-eagled on the floor of the Capitol. The gallery was only one scene of the siege. While the highest-ranking leaders of the Congress were taken to Fort McNair in southwest Washington, the waterfront site of the National Defense University, other senior lawmakers and junior backbenchers were virtual prisoners in their offices and conference rooms. Richie Neal, the Irish-American chairman of the powerful Ways and Means Committee, and a kind of unofficial ambassador from Congress to the Emerald Isle, was on the phone with Brandon Lewis, Britain's Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, when his aides barked at him to end the conversation. "They're out there," his staffers told him. Neil cut off the call and turned out the lights in his committee office just off the House floor so that rioters would not know there was anyone inside. Neil and a few aides pushed the 25-foot-long conference table against the door as a makeshift barricade. As the screaming grew closer, the deputy sergeant-at-arms with Neil asked him and his aides, "Could I ask you all to write down your names and your addresses in case this goes off the rails?" One floor down at the Capitol, Tom Cole, the Oklahoma Republican, was in his Capitol hideaway, one of the cozy, tucked-away offices that a number of lawmakers keep in the building as a perk of their seniority. It was a small suite of rooms stocked with cigars, bourbon, and salted nuts, and ornamented with a buffalo statue, a nod to Cole's Chickasaw heritage. Cole was puffing away at a cigar and watching the proceedings on television with his chief of staff, Josh Grogus, when they heard noise in the hall. They, too, built a makeshift barricade. Before long, there was pounding on the door. The rioters likely did not know much about Oklahoma's 4th Congressional District, which Cole represented, or about the House Rules Committee, in which Cole was the senior Republican, but they could read his name on the door, and when they did, they bellowed it loudly. "Cole!" the lawmaker could hear them shouting. "Come out! Come out!" When the Capitol Police showed up a short while later to escort Cole out of his office, they burst through the door with guns drawn, yelling, "Blue! Blue!" to identify themselves. The first person they saw was Grogus, a broad-shouldered and bearded man dressed casually that day, not all that differently from some of the rioters. The aide quickly explained who he was and that he had a congressman inside who needed to be evacuated. Anthony Gonzalez was locked down in his own office. The Ohio Republican had gone to the House gallery earlier in the day to watch the preliminary proceedings, but he left in disgust after a short while. It was a fateful choice. He returned to his office just as his aides were glued to the television, watching Mike Pence get hauled out of the Senate by the Secret Service. They turned out the lights, closed the blinds, and barricaded the door, and Gonzalez changed out of his suit into jeans, tennis shoes, a T-shirt, and a baseball cap. "If they come in," Gonzalez thought, "basically they can jump over this barricade. I can go out a different door and just outrun them, probably. As long as they don't have a gun," he thought, "I should be fine." He placed a call to the Capitol Police to notify them of unsettling noises in the hall. The woman on the other end of the line did not sugarcoat the situation for the congressman. "If somebody shows up, call us," she said, according to Gonzalez. "But you know, it's going to be tough to get to you." As the congressman settled into a waiting game, he took one other precaution. He wrote a letter to his wife and put it in his desk, just in case. "I just thought, well, I don't know what's going to happen," Gonzalez recalls. "I think I'll be fine, but just in case I'm not, I want to at least get my final thoughts down for her." New Jersey Congressman Andy Kim, a former State Department official who had worked in Afghanistan, was still in the Rayburn building when he got an alert on his phone telling him to shelter in place. The wording of the bulletin was chilling to him. The police said they no longer had control of the building and that lawmakers should stay in their offices if possible. In his office, he called home, trying to beat the news to his wife and children. She had already heard from her co-workers that something was going on at the Capitol, and Kim tried to reassure her that he was all right. It occurred to Kim that there was only one other time when he had called home from work to try to communicate with Cammie before the news networks did that job for him. That was years before he became a member of Congress in 2011, when he was working in Kabul and the American embassy and NATO headquarters came under heavy attack and a siege that lasted nearly a full day. In the Hart Senate office building on the northern side of the Capitol, known as the Senate side, the senators sequestered in a sprawling hearing room were placing calls of their own to make sure family members knew they were safe. One lawmaker was making a different kind of call. Mitt Romney knew he was safe, but he was worried that his family might not be. After he entered the room with an eruption of hot anger about President Trump, Romney called Utah's newly inaugurated governor, Spencer Cox, on his personal cell phone with an urgent request. "Please," Romney asked him, "could you dispatch the state police to my home outside Salt Lake City?" It was hardly an overheated or panicked entreaty. The most immediate audience for Trump's incitement was his crowd in Washington. But MAGA activists all over the country had heard and seen his remarks on television that day, and they had been bombarded with his venomous tirades on social media for months. There was no more recognizable Republican dissident in the country than Mitt Romney. Even before the riot, he had already been berated on airplanes by seething Trump fans. There were some reports that there were protesters heading to the Romney home, their personal home, Cox says. I immediately got the highway patrol there, and we got the family out of there. Congress is full of leakers. Some secret meetings and conference calls don't even end before the leaks begin. But this moment required total secrecy so as not to tip off the rioters about their location. "Nobody announce your location to your staff," yelled Ben Sasse, a Nebraska Republican. Somebody else then hollered, "Or your family!" Hoping to assuage the lawmakers' concerns and perhaps buy some time, a Capitol Police captain addressed the group and stated what was obvious to the senators looking at their phones. "Right now, the Capitol is breached," the captain said, explaining that the plan was to move all 100 senators to buses that they were bringing in behind the Hart Building. "We need you to be patient, and then we'll move you in orderly fashion." One senator, however, was growing impatient. Having spent the previous 2 months soothing and stroking the unhinged president, Lindsey Graham now vented anger at the mob Trump had unleashed. When another police officer stood up to speak, the South Carolina senator did not let him do so for long. "Our evacuation plan," the officer began, "is to come here in SH-216, hold until we determine what the next step is going to be." At this, Graham, who was situated close to the officer in the front of the room, loudly interjected. "The next step is to get him out," he said. "Whatever force you need to do, you're here to protect us. This is the center of democracy. You let people breach the Capitol." But some of Graham's colleagues recoiled from his outburst, viewing it as so much grandstanding from a politician who loved attention. "Shut up, Lindsey," called out Sherrod Brown, the Ohio Democrat. Another person could be heard calling out, "There are no cameras, come on." The officer tried to pick up where he had left off. Their plan, he said, was to secure the Capitol. "I don't know how long that's going to take," he acknowledged. "It could take a while, so just hold on, try to get some water, and we'll keep you abreast of what's going on here as we try to make a determination of the next step here." Another officer spoke up to impress upon the captive senators just how dire the situation was. "We're securing the Capitol. And it's taking time because we have a lot of injured officers and a lot of injured civilians inside the Capitol that we're getting out right now," he said, exhorting the lawmakers to stay put. "The worst thing you can do is walk away, and then if we make a decision to leave here, we don't want to lose you." Graham didn't leave, but the South Carolinian could barely stand still. He was a ball of nervous energy, and in an interview, his inner monologue poured forth. An Air Force reservist who had repeatedly traveled to combat zones as a senator, he suggested the rioters should be dealt with like Islamist insurgents. "Look, this will work out," he said. "I was on a base in Iraq when they breached the gate. Suicide vest on. We all hunkered down. You could hear the..." He imitated the cadence of machine gun fire. Graham did not, however, mask his disappointment with Trump, the president to whom he had been a fiercely supportive political partner. "Trump," he said, "plays the TV game, and he went too far here." His mind flitting from one subject to the next, Graham expressed optimism that the riot could become a turning point. "People will say, I don't want to be associated with that. There will be a rallying effect for a while. The country says we're better than this," Graham said, adding that perhaps the incoming president was the right man at the right time. "I mean, how mad can you get at Joe Biden?" For all his effort to put on an upbeat face, however, Graham was stewing. As he saw that Trump was declining to forcefully condemn the attack, Graham leveled a threat at the White House. Telephoning the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone, the senator told him that if Trump did not act more aggressively to denounce the mob, "We'll be asking you for the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from office." Nearly every senator was present and accounted for by this point, either because they were in the Hart Building, because they were among the very few locked down at Fort McNair. But one member of the Senate leadership was still stranded in the Capitol as rioters ransacked the building. During the certification debate, Patty Murray of Washington State had gone to her hideaway in the Capitol. Murray, the third-ranking Senate Democrat, did not evacuate along with the rest of her colleagues because from her hideaway, she did not know what was happening. Roy Blunt, the senior Missouri Republican who was close with the Capitol Police, got on the phone with Murray and told her he was dispatching officers to hustle her away. Blunt told his Democratic colleague the name of the officer who was coming for her and that he would identify himself when he arrived at the hideaway. Murray was nervous, and with good reason. She had been hearing people outside her door. One had barked something like, "I saw one of them in there," and she was hesitant about opening the door. The police eventually spirited her away. As the hours went by in Hart, Blunt and the other senators across the political spectrum grew angrier. "I've been here a long time," said Blunt, who first came to Congress in 1997, "and this is the day I have the most concern about what America projected to the rest of the world." Bernie Sanders also alluded to the images of the United States being beamed across the globe. "This is a nation that has been a model for the world in terms of democracy," he said, "and we have a president who is encouraging insurrection against that very democracy that he took an oath of office to defend." Away from the main hearing room, in a much smaller room across the hall, a self-selected group of Republican senators were plotting their next steps. The group included Ted Cruz, who had been planning to oppose certification of the election. But now there was uncertainty in their ranks. Could they still go forward with their objections given the attack? In that meeting, some senators argued for dropping their opposition to the certification in light of the violence that day. But Cruz pushed back hard. He says that he made the case that they should not let a violent mob dictate how we do our jobs. McConnell was more eager than ever to quash the objection effort. And before he was taken to Fort McNair, the Republican leader had flashed a rare kind of emotion to one of his colleagues. Tim Kaine of Virginia, the Democrat who had been Hillary Clinton's running mate in 2016, had quietly formed a sort of friendship with McConnell. Approaching McConnell in the Hart building after the insurrection began, Kaine told him that he knew it had to be a painful day for the Senate Republican leader, given his devotion to the institution that was under attack and his loss of the Senate majority he had fought so hard to claim. "Neither of those things would have happened had it not been for Donald Trump," Kaine told McConnell, according to his memory. McConnell said nothing in response. "But the anger I saw in his eyes," Kaine says, "was unlike anything I have ever seen. And he was not mad at me." Soon enough, McConnell had been taken to Fort McNair along with the other congressional leaders. Surrounded by their Capitol Police details and uniformed soldiers, the lawmakers at McNair were at first separated by party. John Thune, McConnell's deputy, was working his cell phone, trying to reach the senators who had been planning to challenge the certification. Given what was going on, he asked the ones he could reach would they consider backing off their objections whenever the Senate reconvenes. The same push was taking place at the staff level. Steve Daines, the Montana Republican who had developed a warm relationship with Trump, had been planning to join Cruz and a number of other senators to object to the certification. But Daines changed his mind after the attack began, and his top aide, Jason Thielman, drafted a statement that he hoped the dozen-strong group of Senate objectors would sign together. "We now need the entire Congress to come together to vote unanimously to certify the election results," Thielman wrote, supplying the senators with the language to explain a pullback. "We must rise above the violence. We must stand together as Americans. We must defend our Constitution and the rule of law." Thielman sent the proposed statement to other chiefs of staff of senators in the Cruz-led group. He got no immediate pushback, but the staffers were in spotty contact with their evacuated bosses and unable to reach consensus on their own. At McNair, as the congressional leaders began to mingle across party lines, McConnell muttered a brief congratulations to Schumer on capturing the Senate majority. The development that had, up until a few hours earlier, been the most important political news of the day. But now both McConnell and Schumer were mostly focused on reconvening the Senate and bringing order back to Capitol Hill. McConnell felt that returning to the Capitol was an overwhelming imperative, and the country had to see that the attack had failed and the Senate could carry out the business of democracy. On a call with Pence and top Pentagon officials, The Republican leader said, "The thugs won't win." Hoyer remembers McConnell using other heated language, demanding the Trump administration had to damn well get this thing under control. Schumer was just as frustrated. With Trump having pushed out his attorney general and defense secretary, there were only acting officials at two departments critical to the continuity of government, Jeffrey Rosen at Justice and Christopher Miller at the Pentagon. Schumer got both men on the phone and pressed them to promise that they would urge Trump to call off the rioters. Schumer and Pelosi pressed Rosen hard. "Can you tell us now," they demanded, "that you will tell Trump to publicly call off the rioters?" Rosen would not promise. "Disgraceful," Schumer told Pelosi. The two Democratic leaders then took matters into their own hands, issuing a joint statement. "We are calling on President Trump to demand that all protesters leave the U.S. Capitol and Capitol grounds immediately." With Trump still invisible, the leaders at McNair saw Biden address the unfolding situation from his home base in Wilmington. He had been slated to make remarks about the economy, but events had overtaken things. "At this hour, our democracy is under an unprecedented assault," Biden began, speaking in a level tone. Branding the riot the work of a small number of extremists, the president-elect called on the mob to pull back and demanded that Trump bring an end to the siege. So far, there was no sign Trump was working toward that end. Kevin McCarthy was as determined as the rest of the lawmakers to return to the Capitol, and by this point, he was the only one of the four congressional leaders on speaking terms with the president. In a direct call to Trump, he implored the president to tell his supporters to go home. But when Trump released a video addressing the mob, it was hardly a stern denunciation. He repeated once again that a landslide victory had been stolen from us, before adding that everyone should disperse and go home for the sake of peace. As the hours went by, and afternoon turned to evening, McConnell spoke repeatedly with another House Republican who was back in the Capitol complex and who shared his anger about Trump far more fully than McCarthy. Liz Cheney had come to Congress the same month Trump arrived in the White House. A national security hawk like her father, she had parted ways with Trump on foreign policy but largely muted her concerns about his conduct. After his defeat, she stood out among the otherwise pliant House Republican leaders in her refusal to abet Trump's effort to undermine the election. "Are they going to stop their objections?" Cheney asked McConnell of the pro-Trump senators who had concocted an elaborate pretext for challenging the election. "McConnell and his deputies were pushing all of the senators who had been planning to oppose certification, but it was not clear how many of them would relent." They would find out in a few hours. Cheney, however, was already thinking past that day. As the Wyoming Republican was being evacuated from the Capitol to the Longworth building a short while earlier, she had crossed paths with Hakeem Jeffries, the Brooklyn Democrat regarded by much of his party as a future Speaker of the House. Cheney and Jeffries were the chairs of their respective caucuses, and they had developed a cordial, if not close, relationship dealing with joint logistical matters. Encountering Jeffries, Cheney said they had to take action against Trump. Jeffries said they should discuss the matter further once they got to a secure location. While the senators were hustled over to the massive and modern Hart hearing room, House members were taken to the older and slightly more gilded confines of the Ways and Means Committee's hearing room, filled with oil portraits of previous chairs of the prestigious Tax Writing Committee. The room was now a refuge for panicked lawmakers and the site of the first strategy session over Trump's second impeachment. Tom Malinowski, a former diplomat turned New Jersey congressman who had been in the House gallery, approached Cheney once he saw her in the room. The two did not have much in common, but both had served in the State Department, and Malinowski suspected Cheney might share part of his perspective on the events of that day. "Liz, I hope you'll agree with us, but the moment we get the all clear, the moment it is safe to go back, we've got to get back in that chamber," Malinowski said, according to his recollection. "Yeah," she said, "and impeach the son of a bitch." Malinowski was taken aback because Cheney was ahead of him. He was a Democrat, and he was not even thinking about impeachment yet. But he quickly agreed to discuss the idea. Jeffries, too, was struck by Cheney's determination to confront Trump. Once they got to Longworth, she told him that she was going to talk to McConnell about impeachment because he, too, felt something had to be done to punish Trump for the riot. To Jeffries, that was the signal that she was serious about taking action, and not just venting about Trump in the midst of an evacuation. But first, the unlikely duo, a conservative white woman from Jackson Hole whose parents were vice president and second lady, and a progressive black man from Brooklyn whose parents were a social worker and a substance abuse counselor, had to calm their members. Once they had been in the Ways and Means room for a little while, members realized the higher-ranking House leaders had been taken elsewhere. It was up to Cheney and Jeffries to take charge. That was no easy task. Fear and anger were rippling through the room, triggered not only by the riot, but also by the refusal of some Republican lawmakers to wear face masks in the confined and crowded space. When Bill Johnson, a pro-Trump Republican from Appalachian, Ohio, tried to lead the room in a prayer, he was all but shouted down by Democrats who blamed him and his ilk for the attack that led to their predicament. A bunch of us were like, "Fuck you right now," right? "No, you don't get to do that," one moderate Democrat says. Other Democrats grew even angrier when Lisa Blunt Rochester tried to distribute masks and was rebuffed by Republican lawmakers who insisted on being barefaced despite being bunched together. The fear of physical violence was still present. Lauren Underwood, the young Illinois Democrat, remembers that Colin Allred, a Texas Democrat and former NFL linebacker, was carrying a long metal pole of the kind used to hang velvet rope lines. "I'm going to keep Colin in my sight," Underwood thought to herself, "because if something happens right behind him, he's got a weapon and he's a big guy." Malinowski was still making his way around the room, talking to his colleagues about the symbolic importance of returning to the House floor that evening. But he did not always find a receptive audience for the message that they had to show the world American democracy was safe. Katie Porter, a California progressive, shot back, "What I learned today is that we're not safe." Among Democrats, there was also tension flaring about the role of the Capitol Police and whether the force had done its best to protect them. When Sherry Bustos, the Illinois Democrat, told a group of colleagues in the room that she hoped the day would be a lesson to lawmakers about the importance of police, "They just saved our lives," she said. Multiple colleagues were taken aback. The police, other Democrats believed, had failed, perhaps deliberately. One Democrat showed Bustos a video already rocketing across social media that appeared to show the police allowing rioters to pass by unimpeded. "Look at this video. You still want to defend police?" the Democrat, whom Bustos declined to name, asked her. She could not deny the video was troubling. Bustos texted the clip to her husband, a county sheriff back in Rock Island, to ask for an explanation. "They're overrun," he responded. "Their own lives are in danger." Recognizing the ugly environment at hand, Cheney and Jeffries determined that they had to speak with one voice to the huddled members. They had to impress upon them the importance of keeping their location secret and, eventually, returning to the Capitol to finish certifying Biden's victory. The duo spoke twice to the members, the second time to a round of applause after the announcement that they would soon return to the chamber. Cheney and Jeffries were addressing the room a third time that night when Pelosi and Hoyer returned from Fort McNair to join them. Pelosi entered as Jeffries was speaking, and the young Democrat immediately yielded to the speaker, who thanked him for holding things down in her stead. Anna Eshoo remembers coming up behind her dear friend, the Speaker of the House, and kissing her on the shoulder. When Pelosi neglected to mention Cheney, Jeffries spoke up to thank his Republican counterpart, noting they had worked as partners throughout the day. It was an illustration of the respect Democrats had come to have for Cheney in the months after the election and in those hours of crisis on January 6th. It also showed why a staunch conservative would soon come to be more admired by liberals than by her fellow Republicans. For the moment, there was a pervasive mood of relief. The Capitol, it seemed, was secure. The work of the Congress would go on. Yet the chaos of the day had spread beyond Capitol Hill. There had been pro-Trump protests in state capitals around the country, and some of them had yielded spasms of political violence. At the Oregon Capitol in Salem, demonstrators had burned an effigy of Governor Kate Brown. In Phoenix, protesters had broken windows at the Arizona Capitol and assembled a guillotine there. In New Hampshire, Chris Sununu, the Republican governor, was watching the insurrection on television in his office and wondered if there would be copycats in his state. He called the state police right away. "Give me another bunch of cruisers here at the state house," he said, according to his account. In Minnesota, Tim Walz was working in the state capitol, but his 14-year-old son was back at home when protesters marched on the governor's mansion. The state patrol swooped in to evacuate Walz's son to a secure location. Hundreds of demonstrators menaced the nearby state capitol with audible chants about civil war. In Washington state, a MAGA mob breached the security perimeter around the governor's residence. Jay Inslee, a former presidential candidate best known as a champion of fighting climate change, was on a Zoom call and trying to ignore the chanting he heard outside when a state trooper burst into the room. "You need to go right now," the trooper said, according to the governor's memory. "You need to go to the safe room." A large group of insurrectionists, some of them armed, had broken through the gates around the residence, though none of them made it inside. As with the riot in Congress, there was no telling what might have happened had the mob reached Inslee before the troopers. Unbeknownst to most members of Congress, the work of punishing Donald Trump had already begun. While most of their colleagues were in the Ways and Means room, a pair of House Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, Ted Lieu of California and David Cicilline of Rhode Island, were in Cicilline's office in the Rayburn House office building crafting what would eventually become the impeachment article against Trump. The Rhode Islander, an attorney and former Providence mayor, had watched Trump's speech that morning. When Cicilline then saw the Capitol being attacked, he immediately recognized it was no accident. It was obvious to him that a great crime had been committed and that Congress would have to act. "This is all connected," he thought. Because he was not on the House floor when the building was breached, Cicilline remained in his office throughout the ordeal and used the time to strategize with Lieu, who had fled his own office, and Judiciary Committee staff about what the language of the impeachment should say. As the House members returned to the chamber, they did so under a dark cloud. They still had to vote on the Republicans' objection to the election results, and there was no sign that the GOP would relent after the horrors of the day. As the certification debate dragged on, Andy Kim remembers that for the first time, a colleague approached him around 2 a.m. and asked him for his thoughts on impeaching Trump. "I'm not in the right state of mind right now to make determinations," Kim recalls saying. "I need to sleep on this and try to gain a little perspective." Then he asked his colleague, "How fast is this moving?" The answer, it would soon become clear, was extremely fast. House Republicans only sped things up further with a vote that showed the unbending loyalty to Trump in the lower chamber. A group of 147 members, the overwhelming majority of the GOP conference, voted to object to the election results from one or more states. Kevin McCarthy, just back from Fort McNair, was among them. When the senators returned to their chamber, it was still unclear what Trump's bitter enders would do. As they walked, the senators who had been planning to object ignored reporters' questions about their intentions. It was just after 8 p.m. when Mike Pence, back on the Senate dais, declared a dark day in the history of the United States Capitol. The always stern vice president spoke the words Trump refused to utter. "We condemn the violence that took place here in the strongest possible terms." He also took care to note that the Congress had reconvened within hours of the attack to support and defend the Constitution. "Let's get back to work," he said, prompting a lengthy standing ovation. McConnell took the floor first and said he had a message for the American people. "The United States Senate will not be intimidated," he declared. "We will not be kept out of this chamber by thugs, mobs, or threats." Barely suppressing his anger, he called the attack a failed insurrection. McConnell did not mention Trump's name, but the man who would soon supplant him as majority leader did. When he rose with his own remarks for the nation, Schumer called the attack the final, terrible, indelible legacy of the 45th President of the United States, undoubtedly our worst. Few senators who spoke that night were more animated than Graham, who belittled the complex election objection rationale engineered by Ted Cruz and rattled off Trump's false claims of fraud and his unbroken record of courtroom defeats.
"Count me out," Graham said. "Enough is enough."
It seemed like a breaking point for a senator who had relinquished his maverick reputation to become a volunteer Trump advisor. And to put an exclamation mark on his comments, Graham offered a word of encouragement to the beleaguered vice president, telling Mike Pence, "Just hang in there." Graham's renunciation of Trump would prove fleeting. But when Romney stood that night to say he had been shaken to the core, there could be no question of his sincerity. His face was flushed, his eyes were red, and his voice was nearly breaking. The Utah senator invoked the people he met abroad who yearned for freedom and looked to this building and these shores as a place of hope. Then he unloaded. "We gather due to a selfish man's injured pride," Romney said of Trump. "No," Romney said. "The fact that Trump's supporters were angry about the election was not sufficient reason to obstruct democracy." Bringing senators on both sides of the aisle to their feet, he declared, "The best way we can show respect for the voters who are upset is by telling them the truth." Standing just inches away was Josh Hawley, the first Republican senator to announce his plans to object. Romney warned his colleagues that anyone who followed through with that scheme would go down in history as being complicit in an unprecedented attack against our democracy. "That will be their legacy," Romney said, with Hawley sitting stone-faced below him. Yet, in a sign of Trump's persistent grip on the GOP and the intransigence of Republican senators who were loath to backtrack in full on an ill-conceived, ill-intentioned plan, only about half of the Republican senators who announced their intent to contest the election abandoned that plan. One of them was Kelly Loeffler, who only days earlier had endorsed the objection scheme in a last-ditch bid to pander to Trump's base in Georgia. Eight other Republicans, including Hawley and Cruz, objected to the votes from one or more states, even as the Capitol was still stained with the mud and blood of insurrectionists. That night, the strategist David Kochel, who had been a Mitt Romney advisor in Iowa since well before his first presidential bid in 2008, emailed the senator to tell him how proud he was of his conduct that day. Romney replied by paraphrasing Winston Churchill. "The GOP was given a choice between dishonor and defeat," Romney wrote. "They chose dishonor. They will have defeat." As Wednesday turned to Thursday and the Senate finished its business, the anger of the lawmakers seemed to continue mounting. The Capitol was filthy. There was trash strewn about, shattered glass on floors throughout the building, and grime smeared the floor of the rotunda. Here and there, smears of blood were visible, including on a bust of Zachary Taylor, the little-remembered 12th president. A few members helped the custodial staff, but it was difficult to clean up thoroughly with soldiers and police in seemingly every corner of the building. Because of all the broken glass, the bomb-sniffing German shepherds deployed in the complex had to be outfitted with black booties on their paws to avoid injury. It was already easy to detect some of the Republican votes for impeachment. Fred Upton, a Michigan Republican and one of the longest-serving members of the House, stood in the defiled rotunda and said Trump would be marked forever by the events of that day. "This is his legacy," Upton said. Walking outside the Senate, Lisa Murkowski, the Alaska maverick, said flatly the GOP should break with Trump, and January 6th showed why. "I think today was a pretty good example," she said. And Cheney's determination had not faded. Encountering Pence in the rotunda just after midnight, she stopped him to offer her gratitude for his comportment that day, calling him a patriot, and telling him she admired his courage. "Thank you so much," Pence replied. As she headed to the Lindy Boggs room, the cloakroom reserved for female members, Cheney told reporters the day had been a tremendous tragedy and an insurrection. She stopped short of saying in public what she had already said in private about impeachment. Yet even as an aide tried to usher her away from reporters, Cheney signaled her break with Trump and the party he'd continued to dominate. "A president who refuses to leave office and concede after he's lost the vote in the Electoral College is something completely unprecedented and very serious, and can't be tolerated, she said. Another Republican congressional leader from the West said in no uncertain terms that it was time for the party to move on from Trump. As John Thune was leaving the Capitol in the early morning hours of January 7th, he reflected that the Republican Party had to have a reckoning about its identity pretty soon. Our identity for the past several years was built around an individual, he said. We've got to get back to where it's built on a set of principles and ideas and policies. Thune expected that in the struggle to liberate his party from Trump, he could count on the Republican Senate leader as a crucial ally. Mitch McConnell had been uneasy about Trump since he entered the 2016 primary. The Kentucky conservative had hoped his fellow Senator Marco Rubio would win the nomination, and when Trump emerged as the dominant candidate, McConnell told his Senate colleagues that if Trump was hurting their own re-election campaigns, then they could drop him like a hot rock. But Trump had won in 2016, and for most of the last 4 years, McConnell had made an uneasy but productive peace with a president he came to see as a means to the end of cutting taxes and appointing conservative judges. McConnell never grew close to Trump, like Kevin McCarthy, but viewing Trump as something of a useful idiot, he had routinely enabled or ignored his norm-breaking ways and flagrant corruption. The first time Democrats had impeached Trump for pressuring a foreign government to smear Joe Biden, McConnell backed the president to the hilt. And when Trump started down the path that led to his second impeachment, spreading pernicious lies about the legitimacy of the 2020 election, McConnell largely held his tongue, putting his electoral interests in Georgia first. By the early hours of January 7th, McConnell had had enough. His majority was broken, the Capitol was desecrated, and the country was humiliated in the eyes of the world. The Senate Republican leader summoned his staff into his chief of staff's office and delivered an impromptu speech that was one part pick-me-up for downcast aides and one part jeremiad against the president whose followers had put the Congress under siege. Donald Trump, McConnell said, was a despicable human being. We all knew he was unqualified, but some thought he'd grow into the job, McConnell said. We quickly learned he wouldn't grow into the office, so we tried to make the best of it, he went on. They had done good work for the country, McConnell assured his staff, and they had constrained the president in important ways. Now, McConnell said, we will have to fight him politically. Not long after, McConnell prepared to leave the Capitol after perhaps the worst day of his career. Seeing one of the authors of this book on the ground floor, McConnell made clear he wanted a word and stepped inside a doorway opposite the Senate dining room. What do you hear about the 25th Amendment? He asked, eager for intelligence about whether his fellow Republicans were discussing removing Trump from office. Then McConnell said he had talked to Schumer and Pelosi at Fort McNair about the possibility of issuing a joint statement urging Trump to stay away from Biden's inauguration on January 20th. Strikingly, after all the trauma of the day, the 78-year-old senator seemed almost buoyant. It soon became clear why. Trump, McConnell said, was pretty thoroughly discredited by this. He put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger, he said. Couldn't have happened at a better time. But would rank-and-file Republicans walk away from Trump? McConnell entertained the question by invoking one of his proudest political triumphs, his sustained campaign in the 2014 elections to clobber insurgent candidates on the far right. He had run the tables that year during primary season, and his reward in November had been capturing the Senate majority. He had taken on the extremists, and he had won. We crushed the sons of bitches, he said. And that's what we're going to do in the primary in 22. Beyond that promise of payback, McConnell remained focused on Trump personally and the havoc he had inflicted on the Capitol. His treatment of Pence had been disgraceful but unsurprising to McConnell. There are no permanent allies with this guy, he said of the president. But what was his larger reaction to the day? How did Mitch McConnell feel as he absorbed the images of the rioters in his beloved Senate? Mitch McConnell seldom discusses his feelings at any articulate length, even in private. You ask me how I feel, he replied. I feel exhilarated by the fact that this fellow finally, totally discredited himself. As McConnell left the Capitol in what he hoped was a new day, he might not have known how immediately Trump's fate and the fate of the Republican Party
would rest in his hands.